Shalom. Thank you for listening to this week's message from Emmaus Road Fellowship, where we encounter Yeshua in the scriptures. Check out our website at walkingemmausroad.org, where you'll find additional teachings and information on visiting us in Kingwood, Texas. If you've been blessed by this ministry, please consider giving to support Emmaus Road's mission of spreading the good news of the kingdom. May God grant you shalom in the name of Yeshua, our Messiah.
Good morning, Shabbat Shalom. We are in Bamidbar. We're starting the book of the Torah. Bamidbar means in the wilderness. It's the fourth book of the Torah. It bridges the journey from the Exodus to the threshold of the Promised Land. The Hebrew name comes from the opening in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of meeting on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt." So he spoke in the wilderness. Midbar is where it comes from. And the thing about the Midbar is that this portion is always read the Sabbath before Shavuot. So even though the timeline is maybe a little bit off, they've already gone to Mount Sinai, and then they're established, and God's about to count them, but we celebrate the celebration of Shavuot is the giving of the Torah on Sinai. It's the giving of the Holy Spirit in that upper room after Yeshua had ascended into heaven. And so, but they talk about, or it's discussed, Shavuot is like the final portion of the celebration of Passover. So we're in the middle of counting of the Omer. We've counted 44 days. I had to make sure I counted last night. I got my little counter. My reminder is basically Jacob, to be honest with you. So that's kind of a fun transition when it comes to reminder counting. And it's also in Jewish tradition, the Midbar. It's often seen as a book of testing and transformation, a transition from redeemed slaves to a covenant people. And it's a story of learning trust, order, holiness, and dependence of God. And it's about the wilderness as a place to learn humility under the care of God. That last part I took from Richard's sermon last week. That was my notes. Just making sure, letting you know I take some notes sometimes. So in what was supposed to have been somewhat of a quick trip to the Promised Land, the wilderness became a refining place rather than merely a travel route. So the sages point out that the wilderness becomes the place where distractions are removed so that the voice of God can be heard clearly. And so before we continue to move forward in regards to this Torah portion, I felt like the Lord was saying, I loved it, the words were just kind of right on target. Felt like the Lord was saying, I wanted to remind you, if you are counted, you are positioned, and you are purposed for what he is doing here on earth. And if there's anything you get from this morning, it's just know the Lord sees you, he knows you, and he loves you in such a way that he is positioning you to express himself to the world through you. And so, the three main themes this morning is the preparation in the desert, and are we taking full advantage of that time? And then what does it mean to be counted? What is God saying to us when he's counting us? And do we truly understand our purpose and position within God's bigger picture? And so when I was thinking about this, just a baseball analogy came to my mind. And it was, talking about preparation, planning. So I came this morning, I don't know if we've ever had this before, but we have some props this morning. So, Chris, you got to up your game, man. So, I played a little ball. I played some in college. I was okay. And I'm not being, humble. I was just okay, to be honest.
And so, but it, as I was thinking about this, you're in the desert, there's a time of preparation. Because the thing that I was thinking about the most of this is, yes, God counts, and we're going to talk about that. Yes, he positions the tribes around the tabernacle, and there's purpose in those positions. There's order in that. Yes, he assigns roles within the Levite tribes of how to take it down, how to move forward, stuff like this. There's an element of preparation. And I'm thinking, there's a lot of weight on that. And so for some reason, I just kept coming back to my time of just playing ball, playing baseball. And so I don't know if you know this, but it is really hard to hit a fastball. It comes in about, the average Major League Baseball comes in about 94, 95 miles an hour. That's just the average. Some guys I've seen throw 103, and some guys just throw, only 90. But if you think about it too, at 95 mile an hour fastball, by the time it is released from the hand, by the time the catcher catches it, is 0.4 seconds. So you have 0.4 seconds to decide to swing this bat and hit that ball. In 0.15 to 0.2 seconds, your mind is trying to figure out what type of pitch it is and where it's going. And it takes you another 0.15 to 0.2 seconds to literally swing the bat. That's all the time there is. You might have 0.2, 0.1 seconds. And I was doing that this while I was preparing. I was like, you play that fun game, you know, where you put the go on your phone and you push the button, you try to land on it on exactly 1 second. So I was trying to do that with 0.4. And I'm like, it's like 0.56. Oh my gosh. It's hard. It's quick. It comes at you quick. All right. So not sure if you know about it. So you got 0.4 seconds. The whole purpose is to hit the baseball. Now, here's the thing. It's not just hitting the baseball. It's hitting the baseball on a very specific spot on the bat. You could hit it here. Bat's going to crack. You're going to get out. You can get it here. That vibration is going to just basically make your arm useless for the rest of the day, especially on a metal bat. So there's this thing called the sweet spot on a bat. This is where you want to try to hit and make contact with that ball as it's coming in. That sweet spot is about 4 to 5 inches in. It's maybe about 5 to 7 inches long, and it's about, there we go, you don't want to touch that. And it's, are we good? And it's about 1 or 2 inches thick. So that sweet spot is only from about here to here. All right, so now, on top of that, obviously, the pitcher's trying to get you out, correct? That's the whole purpose of the game. He's trying to throw what called 3 strikes is an out, 4 balls, you get on base. 3 strikes, what's the strike zone? Well, home plate is about 17 inches wide. So you got this pitcher throwing 95 miles an hour, has about 17 inches to work with right here. And then from there, the strike zone is different, supposed to be different for each batter. Depends on how tall you are. It's supposed to be, according to the rule book, about the top of the knee to the middle of your chest. Now, through the years, it's kind of adjusted. Most of the strike zones have been about right below the knee to maybe above the belt. So that strike zone, that little rectangle, the reason why they call it a strike zone is because you're supposed to be able to strike the ball when you hit it. That's the area that you can technically hit the ball. So if you watch a ball go through the strike zone, obviously that's strike one. If you swing and miss, that's a strike. If you foul it off, that's a strike. 3 strikes, you're out. If they throw it around that strike zone, it's considered a ball. 4 balls, you get on base. So not only that, but you have, not just to make contact, you've got about 8 different fielders trying to get you out after you make contact. So then, we've got, the odds are against you. The elite of the elite, the best of the best, succeed about 33% of the time. 1 in 3. And so, the average guys, the elite, and I consider those guys that at least play Major League Baseball, they succeed about 25% of the time, 23, And so if you want to know, that's how they figure out batting average. That's a 250 batting average. I don't want to get into all that. But with such great margin for error, you have to ask yourself, how can I best position myself for success against such great odds, against defeat? What must I do to prepare? It's definitely something you can't just get up there and start doing. You can't just pick up a bat and then just hit the ball. What's amazing is that one of the greatest athletes ever, I call him the GOAT, his name is Michael Jordan. Some people think somebody else is better than him. I don't. He actually took about a 2-year break from basketball, tried to play baseball. He did okay. But he was such an elite athlete in one area that he tried to become an elite athlete in another area, and he just didn't do it. And really, that says a lot about your purpose and kind of the lane that you've been called to. And we'll look at, there's 12 different tribes. Actually, Joseph has split the tribe. We got Ephraim, Manasseh, and then we've got Levites around. So everybody has their own position. And I think that story, just a little side note with Michael Jordan, once he kind of got out of his lane, he wasn't the greatest anymore. He wasn't functioning and walking in what he was called to do. And you know what he did? He came back to basketball, and then he won 3 more straight world championships. He wins 3, leaves. I'm kind of glad the Houston Rockets took those two. I would have loved to have seen Akeem Olajuwon in his prime against Michael Jordan, his prime in the finals. But the Rockets took those two, and then Michael Jordan comes back, and then he takes 3 more. So it's not like just anybody can do this. What can I do as an athlete, as somebody preparing to try to become successful when the odds are basically saying you're probably not going to do well? And so there was a moment, though, in my career, I guess you can say, where eventually the game started to slow down a little bit, and it was actually a lot more fun. It was amazing. That 0.4 seconds felt like 2 seconds. That little pea ball thing, just when it's coming in there real quick, you can barely even see it. That thing just blossomed into what looked like a balloon. Man, it was so much fun. But it was the fruit of the preparation to get to that point. And the thing is that practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. So you better make sure that what you're practicing is the correct thing. Because just because you do something over and over again in practice, it's not going to guarantee success. So not only do you want to do the right thing, you want to practice. You want to be in that time of waiting. So what happened was I had to train my body and my hands to be in a position so that I didn't have to think. So what I would do is I would take the bat. Man, this is a lot of fun up here. I would take this bat, and then I would practice it because it's 17 inches long. This plate is 17 inches long. Sometimes that ball comes in. Sometimes that ball comes out. Just the slightest deviation of the bat can mess up where you want to hit it. So I had to train myself of where to make contact with the bat on an inside pitch. I had to train myself where to make contact with the ball on an outside pitch. Because if I swing like this on an inside pitch, that's not working. If I swing like this on an outside pitch, that thing's going by me. And again, you've got 0.2 seconds to figure out where it's coming. So, time and time and time and practice and repetition and being in the batting cages and loving it, loving the practice. Loving getting sweaty and going out to the batting cages on a Friday night instead. There was a love of the game that I had that allowed me to taste at least a little bit of success. I couldn't even imagine that if some friends had actually made the show, the majors. And I asked them one time, I was like, dude, what is it like? Do you like it? Is it great? Is it everything we dreamed of? And he's like, yeah, it's so much more. Like, well, you didn't have to say that. So not only that, not only do you have to position yourselves, create muscle memory so that you don't have to think, because that's the thing. Don't think. Anytime I coach any kids, it's like, your practice is what prepares you for those at-bats. Don't think. It's going to mess you up. So then on top of that, we've got this ball. It's round. We've got this bat. It's cylindrical. And the whole purpose is to hit it square. I mean, come on. And then you've got what's a fastball, like this. And that's where you get that point four. But all of a sudden, it moves. If you do this a little bit, that fastball will go this way. If you do this a little bit, the fastball will go this way. If you come and you see it like this, that's a curveball. If right here, if you see it spin, and you see the rotation, that's a slider. Now they have something called a sweeper, which I think is a glorified slider. I don't know. That kind of snuck in there. Then you've got what's called a forkball. Then you've got what's called a split ball. Then you've got a knuckle. And then you've got all of these different style of pitches that change location, that change speed, and the whole purpose is to keep you off balanced. But if you've practiced enough and you recognize and you learn to recognize the pitches, you let muscle memory take over. And it's so much fun. It is so much fun when you have the confidence saying, I have prepared for this moment. No matter what he throws at me, I know I've got a chance to get a hit. And sometimes it's amazing. You don't even know how quickly your body will move when you allow your mind to kind of get out of the way and your body to react to what you've been practicing this whole time. You've created a muscle memory for every single scenario that pitcher can throw at you. So when you're in the desert, when you're in transition, when God is saying, I'm about to show you something fantastic, are we excited enough to just even go take some batting practice, go spend some time with the Lord? I love spending time with the Lord, even though things aren't going well. Practice is what the reality is. We must train our body to be able to respond and to react. We must train our mind to be prepared for every single scenario that might come. Are we going to get it right all the time? No. Remember, the greatest and the best only succeeded maybe 33% of the time. The greatest ever had like a .367 batting average. Nobody touches that anymore. And that's the thing, too. Then every at-bat is a learning opportunity to get to the next one. And so that's, when I was reading about this, when I was thinking about this time, we're in this transition, we're in the desert. How are you treating this time? How are you preparing yourself? When I think about preparation, I always go back to my time playing baseball. So much of what I was able to do in the games was because I worked my tail off when nobody watched me and nobody could see me. And I loved it. When you start to love practice, that's when you know you love the game. Practice hard so that the game is easy. I think Tom Brady said that. So we're in that in-between season of Passover and Shavuot, a place and time to prepare ourselves and create space for God to pour into us and receive all that he desires to give us. So the preparation in the desert, are we taking full advantage of that? At the office, anytime I have to think, I'll pick up a bat and just start swinging it. My manager will pick up a golf club and start swinging it, and we'll just have conversations and strategies over opportunities. And so we're just kind of swinging the club that we love to play ball with. So as it pertains to Shavuot, we're entering a season where God is preparing to speak. I know Shavuot is next Sabbath. And so, if we're not paying attention, if we're not preparing ourselves, if we're not putting the effort behind the scenes into it, we could miss what he's saying. And it's not because he didn't say it. It's because sometimes we just forgot to show up. So in Scripture, we see that when God was about to release instructions of impartation, he first prepares the people. Specifically, at this time of Shavuot, at Sinai, the Israelites dedicated themselves before God. It says in Exodus 19, chapter 10, verse 12, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set boundaries for the people all around, saying, Take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death.'" And then we see it at the same time in the upper room. "And being assembled together with them, he commanded them not to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father, which, he said, he being Yeshua, 'You have heard me, for truly John baptized with water, but you shall be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now.'" And I'm also reminded, too, of the Master Yeshua in the desert. This is Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry. And it wasn't until after his time in the wilderness that Yeshua began his ministry. And what did Yeshua preach right after that? "From that time, Jesus began to preach and to say, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" It's in the wilderness where God reshapes your identity before your inheritance of your commissioning arrives. I feel like a lot of people that are in that wilderness season right now are about to step out of it. I really believe we're in such a season. That God is about to remove the veil from our eyes and allow us to truly see a greater level of his glory here on earth. And in seeing it, we are about to participate in a greater level of his kingdom being expressed. And it's funny, there almost seems to be a theme. The last time I came up here and spoke, I talked about, what was it? Here we go. Good thing I took some notes. It's about the Lord was birthing something. That's right. It felt like that the Lord was speaking into people's lives and giving them a direction or a word about what their purpose was, a calling, a ministry, a business, a school, a family, that God had spoken into your lives, and he was telling you that in the time of your pregnancy of those words, how you respond matters. And that was November 22nd. I know because it was Jacob's birthday. And then this time, I didn't even think about it or connect it until really last night as I was going over my notes. And this time, it's like God is saying, hey, in this wilderness, you're about to walk out of it. Almost so if I connect it, hey, whatever I impregnated you with about 6 months ago, it's a quick pregnancy. You're about to walk out of it. How have you been preparing yourself? Remember, how you wait along for those promises matter. How you prepare yourself to receive the next steps and the next instructions matter. And here's the good news. You've got 5 days left. Also, here's the good news. You could actually count the days on this one. But he's reminding us that how we wait on him during the process or that waiting season matters. And now we've almost completed the counting of the Omer, a time of preparation to receive what God desires to give us for the next season, or to take into account what I talked about last time, give birth to the vision and the promise that God impregnated us with. And what we need to take into account is this, that there's always a process of transformation and preparation that we must walk through before we can fully receive a new revelation of what God is doing. And why is that? Because a revelation is not just about receiving new information. Hearing God is not just about learning new words, but it's about becoming the kind of person who can properly carry out what God is revealing to you. And that's the purpose. Man, He loves you so much. It's going to sound weird that He's willing to give you a wilderness season to prepare your heart for something even greater than what you've asked for. And that is why Bamidbar is so significant. As it means in the wilderness and throughout Scripture, the wilderness is not just a physical location. It's a place of spiritual formation. It's the place where God teaches dependence, where humility is formed, where self-sufficiency is stripped away, where we learn to hear His voice more clearly. The wilderness refines our identity. It allows us a different perspective to take into account what God is about to do. It reveals what is truly in our hearts and teaches us whether our trust is genuine or not. And it's okay if you lack trust, lack faith. Just don't do it by yourself. You have brothers and sisters that would love to prop you up and walk with you. But the wilderness season, it can be incredibly difficult because it often makes people feel forgotten, directionless, and insignificant. But yet, what does God do in the wilderness? What's the first thing He does in Bamidbar? He counts them. Before God moves His people forward, He reminds them, I see you. What does it mean to be counted? What is God saying to us when He is counting us? I think I changed my notes about 4 or 5 different times on this little section, so I've got a lot of scribble here because there's a lot to it, and I'm just praying that God will allow me to speak it as He wants you to hear it. But the counting of the Omer is counting of days, and Bamidbar begins with the counting of people. And so there's a task. God gives the task. It says, from 20 years old and above, all who are able to go to war, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies, and with you there shall be a man from every tribe, each one the head of his father's house. There's a lot of people that God's wanting to count, so He delegates. He's got a leader from each tribe. He assigns that tribal leader. That tribal leader does the counting. And then in that first chapter, verse 20 to 46, it counts all of the tribes, and it gives you the total number. And that, let me go back. Boom. And throughout the Torah, we see this pattern again and again. It says, Israel is counted after the Exodus. They're counted after the sin of the golden calf. And again, they're counted now as they move towards their inheritance and come into covenant, the covenant mission. And Rashi points out that God repeatedly counts Israel because of His love for them. He counts what He loves. Because in the Torah, counting is connected to dignity. The Torah does not simply say, count the people. And it doesn't say, take a census either. But here it says, take a census of all congregation of the people of Israel by clans, by father's house, according to the number of names, every male head by head. So from 20 years, and the Talmud says, to about 60. But the Torah, it says, actually, there's a phrase in there, and I don't have this in the Hebrew to show you up there. So Chris, you got me on that one. I got the props, though. Because it says, Se'u et Rosh, lift up the heads of the children of Israel. So counting in the mind of God is an act of elevation. Lift them up. Let me see your head. Look me in the eyes. I want to see you. I want you to know that I see you, that I recognize you. And the Hebrew imagery goes much deeper than mathematics or statistics or numbers and equations. It carries the idea of lifting someone up, recognizing them individually, assigning them purpose, and elevating their identity. Rabbi Foreman with Aleph Beta has an incredible teaching. It's really cool. And it's very powerful. So after they count all of the tribes, they don't count the Levites. It says here in verse 49, I'm going to read 49 and 50. It says, only the tribe of Levi shall you not number. Eventually they take inventory. But nor take a census of them among the children of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, over all its furnishings, and over all the things that belong to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings. They shall attend to it and camp around the tabernacle. And what Rabbi Foreman shows in one of his teachings is that the word you shall not number, or it's my bad, the census and appoint, it comes from the same root word. Let me see if I can say this. Pekat. Pe, kaf, dalet. So what he was highlighting is really, it's really cool. The word carries so much richer of a meaning than just simply numbering. He's not saying don't take a census, but he's just saying that same word meaning two things: to count, to appoint, to assign, to visit, to remember, and even another one, to entrust. Obviously, he is entrusting these Levites for a very special purpose. And even the Hebrew letters kind of paint the picture of what that word means. The pe represents a mouth or a declaration or expression. In fact, we're in the year 5786, in the decade of 80. The word 80 is connected to the letter pe, which means to declare. So we're in the decade of declarations, if you want to look at it that way. The kaf is connected to holiness and distinction. And the dalet, it points to a doorway. It's a pathway. So when God, to say this, paket, he's not merely counting them. He's speaking identity over them. He's setting them apart. He's opening a doorway into their calling. And when you look at it, that's why God counts. He counts the Levites right around. We got the tabernacle in the middle. We've got the Levites just around the tabernacle with very specific instructions on how to manage the things as they move, as they set up. And then outside the Levites, you've got all 12 tribes. So the Levites, they guard holiness. The tribes, they carry a covenant destiny. And God counts Israel because he loves them and they have a mission among the nations to be an expression of him in the world. We even see this word in Genesis chapter 21, verse 1. And the Lord visited Sarah. As he said, And the Lord did for Sarah what he had spoken. Paked. God did not merely remember Sarah intellectually, but he moved toward her destiny. He visited her. I love how the language, there's so much depth in the words. He intervened in her barrenness, as we know that she didn't give birth till a very, very old. She laughed at that promise. And God said, remember? When he visited her, when God visits you, he's reminding you, telling you to remember, I've promised some really cool things, even ones you laughed at. It's going to happen. And he brought attention to the promise spoken over her life. Perhaps being counted just means preparing to entrust God counting us. Sorry, let me read my notes correctly. Is preparing to entrust us with something connected to his purpose and his kingdom. So, do we truly understand our purpose and position with God's bigger picture? Because that is ultimately what B'Midbar is revealing. When God counted Israel, he did not count them randomly. Every tribe had a place. Every family had an assignment. Every person was positioned around the tabernacle with intentionality. No tribe chose their own locations. No tribe defined. God positioned each one according to his design. I'd like to even think that God has positioned you right here, right now. Some were called to guard, some to carry, some to lead, some to worship. Every position mattered because every position was centered around the presence of God. And sometimes where we struggle is we want purpose, but we don't always want order and formation. We want a calling of greatness, but we don't want the preparation to have it and to get there. We want an inheritance and we want a blessing, but we don't want the wilderness season to frame our hearts and minds to receive it. Yet the wilderness, Midbar, is the very place where Israel learned that their identity was not self-created, it was God-assigned. Your purpose, your destiny has been assigned. I even like it. Pray every night. I try to. I don't want to go up here and just, oh, I pray every night. I try. But one of the things that we talk about is how God has written in our books before time ever began a purpose and a destiny to be an expression of him while on earth, and we want all of it. What made Israel distinct was not that they had tribes or banners or assignments, but the presence of God was in the center of them, of all that they did. Until they messed up, and God brought them back. And then they messed up, and then God brought them back. And he keeps doing that until you hit a ground ball, you got the next step back. And then you hit a sweet line drive, hit the sweet spot. It's in the backyard with Jacob, and we were hitting and we have a net. We make sure that we don't face the Franklin's house, just in case what I'm about to explain to you happens. He's hitting the ball, and then all of a sudden, he just crushes it. He hits that sweet spot. It jumps off his bat, and it actually goes through the net, and it goes over the fence behind us. And we just look at each other like, mm-hmm. And we're just kind of backing up. I go, Jacob, you're going to have to go and get that ball.
It was a good hit, wasn't it? It's like, how did it feel? It felt great. But everything flows outward from his presence. If you take a look at how everything is designed, the tabernacle is in the middle. And from there, life is given. Their movement, their identity, their mission, it all depended on his presence. And so God's not simply preparing us to receive more information. He's preparing us to rightly position ourselves around his presence so that we can carry what he desires to release in this next season. Because revelation without the proper position can create confusion. But when we receive that revelation in the correct and right alignment, that can produce transformation. When we have positioned ourselves and purposed ourselves to receive that revelation from God, that's where our hearts are transformed to be that expression of him. So God, as he counted them and set them apart in the desert, set them up, he was not just merely organizing them. He was reminding them, as he counted them, that who they were, where they belonged, what they carried, and how they fit into his covenant purpose. So I just want to go back to that first page of my notes. That God wants to remind you that you are counted, that you are purposed, and you are, and he is positioning you for things that go way beyond what you could imagine. And it's not just for you. It's for a world that doesn't know him to see him. And it's for your brothers and sisters that need him for you to be there for them. All right. That's it. Thoughts. Response. After this.
Honestly, throughout my years, it's hard for me to... I hear about God seeks us, and I internally laugh. I'm like, why is he going to seek us? He's the creator of the world. We should be seeking him, right? Then I recall Maggie's prayer at the very beginning, talking about the last thing she said was, you seek us. And as funny as that sounds to me, it's true. You know, he wouldn't have gone to the cross if he wasn't seeking us. We didn't ask him to do that, right? Mm-hmm. We're completely ignorant in our own death. You know, happy in our rot. But he sought us. And I think it's in Ezekiel when he's God is talking. And he's talking to Israel. And he said, I sought you were nobody. And I sought you out. You were born and left on the side of the road. And I picked you up. I cleaned you. And then you left me. Right? And I'm still seeking you. And it's funny, right? Like, that doesn't make sense. But he models the behavior he desires from us, right? Mm-hmm. And it's funny to me that the creator of the universe displays humility, that he would seek such lowly creatures as us, right? He is our example.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this message, please consider sharing it with a friend or family member and help us out by giving a review on iTunes or other podcast platform. Check out our website at walkingemmausroad.org for additional teachings and information about visiting Emmaus Road in Kingwood, Texas.